I'd like to thank Winston Shroud and Solutions in Commerce for inviting me here today. My name is Rodney Taylor. I just want to thank you guys. I really feel honored and privileged to present to you today. I want to give you a little bit about my background, my why that got me and moved me into this direction of mortgage elimination. This is a free and clear process. And at the end of this process, it's designed to have a free and clear home. About 2 years ago, I was going through a divorce and I was working for the bank in Las Vegas. It's a small Genovo bank, and I was one of the VPs there. A gentleman approached me, and it was really interesting. He told me that, you know, I could possibly save my house when I mentioned him that I lost my house in the divorce. He said if I took 6 months to study, that he would guarantee me that I would have a free and clear house at the end of the process. When that happened, I said, I'm all in. So for 6 months, I studied. He tutored me. He mentored me. At the end of the process, I had a free and clear house. Not only one, but I had two investment properties that I also was able to get a free and clear title to. One property I gave back to my wife. The other two I kept. At the end of that process, I was approached by four or five friends that kind of watched me go through that entire process of getting a free and clear home. When I came to the end of the process, they said, Rod, I'm all in. I want you to do my house. And I said, sure, why not? So I figured if it worked on me, maybe it's possible that it could work for them as well. Completed their homes, they had a free and clear house. And then the process began to go and actually built a lot of momentum. I wasn't aware that it was going to go in the direction that it's gone, and here I am presenting to you today. My background is in private banking. I was a private banker for a number of years. I was in title and escrow, as well as a mortgage lender for about 7 years. In this process, I really started delving into the note and the deed of trust. When I looked at the note and deed of trust, I mean, I looked at it for almost 15 years, and I don't know if any of you have ever really read your note and deed of trust. In those 15 years, I never read the note or deed of trust from start to finish, and never took the time to really understand what it was actually saying. When I started really diving into it, even after my process, I was continuing to research the words and continue to research definitions according to Black's Law Dictionary, seeing exactly what this note and deed of trust is saying. It's amazing. My eyes were open, and actually I went into a depression. I was depressed that the wool had been pulled over my eyes, my mom's eyes, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents' eyes for a number of years. So, I mean, since the days of Abraham, everything has remained the same. And basically, we've all had the wool pulled over our eyes. And it's not that, you know, I'm smarter than you or you're smarter than me. It's just that we've been indoctrinated as this is the way that it is, and this is the ways banks operate. The person with the high back chair, the suit and tie, are the ones that you trust. The people out on the street selling drugs or whatever are the ones you don't trust. Well, I'm discovering that, you know, in my dealings as a banker, that I would trust the person on the street before I trust the banker. Not to disarm you or disalarm you. I just want to let you know that they are so intelligent, and they have thought these words out so precisely that we never know what we're looking at, what we're signing. So this process, hopefully you'll take a look at it. Don't take my word for it. Once again, I want you to do your own research, your own homework, but really take a look at your note and deed of trust with different eyes, with new eyes, and we'll see what you come up with. If you come up with the same conclusion that I reached, this is definitely the process for you. If you feel that something's happened, that some type of fraud has taken place on the note and deed of trust by the banking system, yes, you want to step into this process. If not, I would say this isn't the process for you. This requires a little bit of intestinal fortitude. It requires you stepping out on a limb. It requires you standing up for what you feel is right. And if that is the truth, and that is what you feel, I will walk all the way to the end of the earth with you on this process. I can't take credit for this process. I mean, there's been a lot of people. I mean, down the line from Winston to Sam to a lot of different people that have worked this process. I've just been able, with my background and experience, to put my touch on it, to add a little bit more flavor to it, to add a little bit more credence to it, being on the banking side of the transaction. So with that being said, let's get started. I want to start with, first of all, giving you a few definitions. A few things that we're going to have to discuss and understand is that, you know, one, let's get a clear definition of fraud. When I was in the mortgage community, we used fraud and we threw it around like it was some wet sneaker. You know, you committed fraud, you committed fraud, you committed fraud. Well, basically, fraud is a failure to disclose. And from that failure to disclose, there is a financial gain created. So kind of keep that in the back of your mind. So it's a failure to disclose. And from the failure to disclose, there is a financial gain created. There's also, I want you to understand contracts. I mean, really the true definition of a contract. And the part of the contract that I really want you to focus on is the acceptance, the consideration, and the most important part, the agreement or the signatures by both parties. We're going to talk about UCC. Basically the UCC 104, which speaks about the contracts between countries, the contracts between states. We're going to also talk about the trust, trustee, the trustor, and the beneficiary. We're going to talk about, in the first line of your note, it speaks of a promise, and I want to really define what a true definition of a promise is, as well as what a true loan is. So with that being said, let's get started with the note. The note reads, in return for a loan that I have received, I promise to pay. This note states that they promise to pay $232,850. Okay, let's really break that down. In return for a loan that I have received, I promise to pay $232,850. One more time. In return for a loan that I have received, I promise to pay $232,850. Okay, let's back up for 1 second, and I'm gonna put my banker hat on. This note, or we called it a promissory note. We called it a promissory note when I was in title, when I put the title hat on. When I was a lender, put the lender hat on, we called it a promissory note. When I take a look at this document, I've read this document over and over again from Hawaii to Florida to New York to Alaska. There's no place on this document where promissory and note appear in the same place. Okay? Once again, there's no place on this note where promissory and note appear in the same place. A promissory note is a contractual agreement between two parties. But no place on this note does promissory and note appear in the same place. It says a note at the top of the page, and then it says, I promise to pay. And we assumed in the real estate industry that that's a promissory note. Well, no, it's not a promissory note. And when we break this down, you'll see why it can't be a promissory note. It can't be a contractual agreement. Hey, but let's start with that first sentence. In return for a loan that I have received, I promise to pay. Now, those of you who bought homes, let's picture yourselves at the closing table. You're sitting with either your attorney, your escrow officer, your realtor, or your lender. And they're sitting there, you're sitting there, and you're reading this for the first time. So go back to that date, and now you're going to read this line under the borrower's promise to pay for the very first time. And you're sitting there, and it says, in return for a loan that I have received, I promise to pay. My question to you is, before you sat down at that closing table, did you receive a loan? Most people say no. Because if you didn't, then why does this line read, in return for a loan that I have received? Once again, you haven't signed this document yet. You're reading it for the very first time. And it's already talking about something happening in the past tense. So this document is saying prior to you sitting down at the closing table, you received a loan. And once again, I ask everyone, did you receive a loan prior to sitting down at the closing table? And everyone says no. Well, either you're wrong and you did receive something at the closing table, or this document is wrong and it's written incorrectly because it says that you did receive something. Now, it's interesting. I mean, and I don't want to mention all the big banks, but we all know who all the big banks are, the top five banks. And I've seen documents from top 10 banks and even some of the smaller banks, and every single document reads exactly the same way on this first line. Now, everything after the first line, it varies. It varies from bank to bank, but this first line has never changed and is never changed on any of these documents. Wouldn't you agree that most of these large companies have very large and extensive law firms, attorneys on staff, CPAs that would say, you know what, that line is incorrect. It should say in return for a loan that you will receive. But it doesn't, and they haven't changed it. Obviously, something took place before you sat down at the closing table. When I go through this note, we'll discover what that something is. But let's start with this note. I mean, at the bottom, let's find out how this note operates. It says that it's a uniform instrument. And people say, well, when I read it, and I said, okay, it's a uniform instrument, that means it's the same from place to place to place to place. Well, no, this uniform instrument reads in all caps. It's talking about the UCC, that this document, the note and the deed of trust operate under the UCC, or the Uniform Commercial Code. So based on the Uniform Commercial Code, there is a definite definition for contracts. What I want to focus on is the agreement by both parties. So let's go to the back of that note. On your back of your note, how many people sign your note? I know I signed my note. And I can't remember a banker being there to sign on the bank's behalf. Well, maybe that doesn't apply to this document. Maybe, you know, under the UCC, it states that you have to have two signatures from both parties to have a fully executed contract in addition to consideration. Let's not even talk about the consideration right now, but let's talk about two signatures from both parties. Now, can I go to your, say that I'm going to purchase your house without your signature? Most people say no. Okay, well, what if I put together a purchase agreement? I say I'm going to buy your house for $100,000. I go to the initial every place that I'm supposed to initial, sign the document, take that document to escrow and say that I'm going to buy your home. The escrow officer say, well, hold on. Do you have the signature from the seller? I said, well, no. I don't need the signature for the seller. This is a unilateral contract. If a unilateral contract is valid, that should be a valid agreement. I should be able to buy your house without your signature. It's impossible for me to buy your house without your signature. I know because I was in escrow. I can't buy your house without your signature. It requires the signature from the seller. Now, if that's true, and contracts are the same in all facets, in all areas, then this document is either truthful or it's not truthful. But it can't be both ways. Either this is a contract or this is not a contract. Okay, because I don't know about you, I don't have a signature from the bank. There was no banker present from one of the larger banks that I purchased my home, or who gave me, quote, the loan for my home. There was no one to sign that document. I was the only one present to sign the document. Matter of fact, no one notarized this document, which is kind of interesting as well. If this is truly a contract, wouldn't they need to know that it's really me who's signing this document? Well, this is interesting. This document, if you really break it down and look at it, it's very, very similar to something that I keep in my wallet called a check. Winston calls it a draft or bill of exchange. But think about it. What are the elements of your check? The elements of your check, you have a date. This document has a date. You have a routing number. This document has a routing number. You have who is paid to the order of. This document has an who is paid to the order of. This document also has an amount on it. But the most important thing that this document has that actually executes this check is your signature. Now, let's think about this. If I were to give you a check for $1,000, and I signed the check, I put the amount, I put who was paid to, put the date on it, ripped off the check, gave it to you, and you signed on that check, and you took it to my bank, and attempted to cash that check, would you be successful? The answer is no. As a banker, we check the signature line, and if that signature line has two signatures and the other person isn't on that account, that we void that check automatically. So that check would not clear. This document, if it had the signature of the bank on it, it would not clear. You, I, all of us are the surety on this check. We're the ones who actually create the funds for this check with, yes, our signature. So once we sign, guess what? That's good as gold. Let's go back to that first line. It says, in return for a loan that I have received. Now, generally, it requires, if I were to give you that $1,000 check, you don't have $1,000, correct? You don't have $1,000. You have a $1,000 check. You have to go to the bank and cash that check or deposit into your account and have to withdraw from my account. Something has to take place for you to receive that $1,000. These individuals at the bank are so arrogant and so confident that this check is going to clear that they speak of it in the past tense. In return for a loan that I have received. They know that once you sit at the closing table, this check is going to clear. They don't have to worry about the check clearing. They just have to worry about your signature being on it. And once your signature is on it, they know if you're at the closing table, you're signing it. And guess what? They have $232,850. Now, let's talk about what happens to that $232,850 that's on this document. I'm going to put my title hat on for 1 second. What we do at the title company, and once again, please call your escrow officer and ask them what do they do with the notes when they receive them. I'm going to give you what we did with our notes and what most escrow officers that I've spoken to will do with their notes. We take the notes and we make 3 copies of the notes. Okay. We make 3 copies of the notes and we shred the original. Now, some title companies will actually send back the original with the 3 copies to the bank. Let's put the banker hat on. When I received those notes, they came across my desk, I would take them and stamp the back of them. And I actually have stamp notes that says for to pay to the order of without recourse to the name of the bank. That's kind of odd to put on a contract, isn't it? Well, a supposed contract, but that's what they would put on. That's what I would stamp right on the back of those notes. Doesn't that seem similar to that little check that I gave you for $1,000 that you took to my bank and they stamped the back of it? And have you ever taken time to read what they're stamping? It says, pay to the order of, without recourse, and then your name, or the name of the bank. Basically, these notes are checks. They're called security instruments. Now, on Wall Street, instrument means money. It means cash. It means actually bill of exchange. It means promissory notes. It means things that can be deposited. It means things that can be exchanged for work. This document is actually a check. And that is the reason the bank cannot sign on this document. And that is the reason that this is not a contract. This is interesting. We're going to get to the promise to pay, because I think this will kind of tie everything in. I promise to pay you $232,850. Okay. Let's use our check example of me giving you $1,000. So I gave you $1,000 and we put together an agreement. Okay, we're gonna put together a contract. Okay, I'm gonna give you $1,000. We put the terms, let's say 3 months. We put interest, say, okay, so in that 3 month period, you're gonna pay me back that $1,000. Okay, now it's time to pay. Once again, the check is given. We put together an agreement, we both sign, I give you the money, you give me the contract, I hold onto the contract, you cash the check, we're all happy. Now, would you do this, would you sign the document, I sign the document, and I don't give you the money, and I still hold you responsible to pay me the $1,000? Most people say, no, there's no way I would sign that agreement. There's no way I would ever think about doing that. Well, guess what? On this note, that's what you did. My question is, did anyone receive money at their closing table? I mean, did the bank come in and dump, let's use this example, $232,850 on the table and say, here's your loan? No. Did they give you a money order? No. Cashier's check? No. Wire to your account? No. What about a check? No. I don't think anyone ever received money at the closing table. But we all signed this document gladly. Only thing we're thinking about when we sign this document is, man, I get to move in, moving people, moving company. Okay, it's gonna take me 2 or 3 days to move everything in, get everything organized. Okay, I gotta get my friends together so they can help me. I mean, we're thinking down the line, the bank is thinking, I got a sucker. Because guess what? Just as I gave you that we signed that contract and I didn't give you money, we signed a contract that we never received money. And we walked away with a big smile on our face, thanking everyone, shaking everybody's hand, kissing babies, really, really excited about what's going on. But guess what? We just got really, really reamed, and we didn't even know it. It says a promise to pay. I promise to pay. Now, I wrote down a definition according to Black's Law Dictionary of a promissory note and a promise to pay. It said the words in a promissory note expressing the maker's intention to pay a debt, a mere written acknowledgement that a debt is due, is insufficient to constitute a promise. Now, once again, do your homework. You look at it in Black's Law 7th edition. It says the words in a promissory note expressing the maker's intention to pay a debt, a mere written acknowledgement that a debt is due is insufficient to constitute a promise. I had an individual, I was doing the presentation in front of him and it was really interesting. He said, you know, I keep my promise. And I signed this document. It says, I promise to pay $232,850. I said, awesome. What if, you know, I appreciate that you're an integritous person and that's awesome that you want to keep all your commitments and you want to keep your promises. I think that's fair. But let's use that $1,000 check as an example. Okay, say we fully executed, I gave you the check. We signed the contract, we signed the documents, and say this gentleman over here said, you know what, I'm going to step in on your behalf. Guess what? I'm going to pay Rodney that $1,000 on your behalf. I say, thank you very much. I appreciate you stepping in for this gentleman. Thank you for the $1,000. We shake hands, and then I look to you, and I say, you know, I need my $1,000. You say, well, guess what? It was taken care of over here. This gentleman paid you the $1,000 on my behalf. I said, well, no. He gave me the $1,000, that's true. But you promised to pay me. I'm holding you to your agreement to pay me. But he did pay you. That's what you say. He did pay. Yeah, he did pay. He gave me the money, but you promised to pay me. Now, my question is a promise still a promise if the promise has been fulfilled? Once again, is a promise still a promise if the promise has been fulfilled? What am I saying? I'm saying on this note, when you signed the note, the promise has been fulfilled. And the interesting thing is, I'm delving into this, according to HJR 192, which all of you are familiar with, there has to be a remedy associated with any type of presentment, correct? They're presenting us with the bill, and we don't even know that they're giving us the remedy within the presentment. What am I saying? I'm saying when we sign that note and the bank receives three copies of the note and we stamp it for deposit or pay to the order of without recourse, we're depositing those notes. Guess what? We're depositing three times the amount of what you paid that paid for that house in the first place. Let me say that again. We take those notes. I took them and stamped them and gave them to my COO, who gave them to my CFO, who deposited the notes into the bank. They are checks. They are remedy for your home. You created the money by your signature. They received, before you even receive your keys, three times the amount of your note. Let me say that again, one more time. Before you receive your keys, the bank, off of this, you signing the note, received three times the amount of that note. Man, that almost choked me. Yes, three times the amount. Now, so that is the remedy. Your house is paid for. But you say, well, in the body of the note, it says that I'm to pay an interest rate, I'm to pay an amount, and that's if you choose to. Once again, that promise has been fulfilled by another entity, namely you, by your signature. So if that promise has been fulfilled, are you still obligated for the promise? Well, if you don't know, guess what? You are. If you don't know, you can put yourself back and keep yourself in the contract. And that's what we've all done. We put ourselves back into the contract every single month, every time we make the payment, month after month after month after month for the next 30 or 40 years, depending on the term of our loan. It's opportunity to get out of that. One, this is not a contract. Two, you're now aware that you didn't sign into a contract. This is not fully executed. Let's go back to the Uniform Commercial Code. I mentioned that Uniform Commercial Code was the law of the planet. Basically, it's the law of contracts. I always use this example, and I want to use it here in this setting. My home is in Las Vegas, Nevada. Wells Fargo's head office is in New York City. If I had a contractual dispute with Wells Fargo, which state would take precedence? Would it be Nevada or would it be New York? The Uniform Commercial Code is actually the law that binds states. It's the law that binds countries in contractual agreements. So basically, what would happen is if the laws in Nevada and the laws of New York weren't subordinate to the UCC, the UCC would take precedent in that contractual dispute. So basically, everything goes back to the Uniform Commercial Code as far as contracts. Once again, I'm in the United States. I have a contractual dispute with someone in China. Which country's laws would take precedence? Well, the bank said, well, we can't let this go without recourse. So somehow we have to bind the laws of countries. So once again, the Uniform Commercial Code is a law that binds contractual disputes between countries. Once again, China has its own laws. The United States has its own laws. You marriage the two into the UCC, and we go to the UCC and find out what the UCC says about this contractual dispute, and that's how we would solve that contractual dispute. The cool thing about the UCC is, probably most of you know, is that it's easy to understand. I mean, I don't know, I'm in Nevada, and the NRS is so complex. It's like this loop amongst loops amongst loops, and nothing ever says or states exactly what it is, and you have to go to another statute to find out what another statute means. Well, the UCC is pretty straightforward, and it has to be. Once again, someone in China and someone in the United States has a contractual dispute. It has to be clear enough that one, it's understood in both languages. Two, it's simple enough that both of them can marriage and come to an agreement. So the UCC, I'm backing up because I want you to really understand, the UCC is actually the governing body of your note and deed of trust. I remember an individual said, well, Rod, you know, you said that this note pays for my house. I said, yes, I did. They said, prove it. I said, thank you. I couldn't wait for you to say that. If you look on the deed of trust, it's really, really cool. And usually it's about page 3 or 4, sometimes 5, fifth page of your deed of trust, under the borrower's covenant. Now, it's really, really, really interesting. Once again, do your own homework. Please do your own homework. Check out what I'm saying. And if it makes sense to you, you know, there is remedy. I'm letting you know that there's remedy. But under the borrower's covenant, it says the borrower is lawfully seized of the estate, hereby conveyed, and has the right to grant and convey the property, and that the property is unencumbered except encumbrances of record. Okay, one more time. The borrower is lawfully seized of the estate, hereby conveyed, and has the right to grant and convey the property, and that the property is unencumbered except encumbrances of record. Now, this is the process that most title companies take, or all the title companies take that I've spoken to. You always sign the note before you sign the deed of trust. And once again, you always sign the note before you sign the deed of trust. You always sign the check first before you receive the item. You always pay for the item first before you receive the item. When you go in the grocery store, you pay for your groceries and then you receive the groceries. You don't receive the groceries and then pay for the groceries. Side note. Okay, the borrower is lawfully seized of the estate, hereby conveyed, and has the right to grant and convey the property, and that the property is unencumbered except encumbrances of record. I always like to start from the back and work my way forward. So let's start with encumbrances. What is an encumbrance? An encumbrance is a loan. An encumbrance is a lien. When we signed the note, supposedly we signed a loan. So if we signed the note before we signed the deed of trust, shouldn't that read that the property is encumbered? Because we signed a loan. This person signed a loan for $232,850. Once they sign the loan, it's fully executed. You don't have to wait to deposit that $1,000 check that I gave you. Once I sign it and hand it to you, it's a done deal. You don't have to notarize it. There's not a 3-day right of rescission. Once I give you the check, guess what? You can take that check to my bank and cash it. If there's money in that account, you get the cash. The same with the note. If that's truly a loan, once you sign that document, the loan is fully executed. So on the deed of trust, first of all, it should read that the property is encumbered, but it doesn't. It says unencumbered. Let's back up even further. It says that you have the right to convey the property and grant the property. That's an interesting word, convey and grant, i.e. I have the ability to give the property away. Have the ability to hand it over to you willingly. Let's back up even further. It says that the borrower is lawfully seized of the estate. Now, the interesting thing about that word seized is spelled with an S instead of a Z. S-E-I-S-E-D instead of S-E-I-Z-E-D. That word means all control, all power. So let's read it differently. Let's read it like Black's Law would read it. It says the borrower is lawfully in all power, have all control of the estate, hereby conveys and has the right to grant and convey the property. So with all power and all control, you can give the property away. With all power and all control, without an encumbrance, it is free and clear. So interesting thing is that before, when you read this under the borrower's covenant, you actually have a free and clear house. Once again, when you read this on the borrower's covenant, remember, we're still at that closing table. We haven't left yet. We're reading this deed of trust for the first time. When you read this, you have a free and clear home. Now, what happens from the time you read it to the time you sign this document is that you've given the bank all power, all control of your home. You've conveyed the property to the bank. You've granted the property to the bank. And guess what? You've attached an encumbrance called a loan. We've willingly have given the property to the bank and have put a burden of a loan on our back that we have to carry for the next 30 or 40 years, willingly, unknowingly. But at the same time, guess what? We have to take responsibility for that because we actually orchestrated the whole thing. Now, I want you to go to your deed of trust, your first page on your deed of trust. Now, in some states, it's going to be called different. Different names for different regions. So please, in our region, I'm going to use our region as an example. It's called a deed of trust. Some places call it mortgage deed, mortgagee. There's all kinds of names given to this document, but it's the same body of the document. But under this document, this trust, now take off deed and just think of it as a trust. What are the elements of a trust? Let's look at who the players are in this trust. First of all, usually the trustee or the representative of the trust is usually the title company. If you're in a wet state, it's probably a law firm. That is the person representing the trust, the person out front representing the trust. The beneficiary is usually the bank. It could be MERS. It could be a private investor, private bank. It could be one of those, but it's usually named on your deed of trust. On this deed of trust, it says the borrower is the trustor under this security instrument. Once again, it says the borrower is the trustor on this security instrument. The interesting thing about this is that you will never see trustor mentioned ever again on this document. Once it's mentioned this time as the borrower is a trustor, we are referred to as the borrower throughout the rest of the document. So, whether it's 12, 13, 14, 15 pages, every time they refer to us, they never say trustor, they always say borrower. So, what is a trustor? Let's define who we are on this deed of trust. Once again, under Black's Law, the trustor is defined as the grantor. People have probably seen that. The settlor. Okay? Yeah, everyone's heard that settlor. I like this definition, the creator. Let me say that again. The borrower is defined as a trustor. Defined is the creator. So what does that mean? We are the creator of this deed of trust. Once again, we are the creator of this deed of trust. Did we actually type out the deed of trust and sign it? No, the answer is no. More than likely, a title company did all the typing, a wet state attorney probably did all the typing and gave us the document. And we assume because we didn't type the document that we had nothing to do with it, that we're not even a part of it, that we just signed on the dotted line and everything is great. But if we are the creator of this document, then everything in it was created by us, including the borrower's covenant. So us knowing that we own the property, that we willingly are giving away the property. So according to the bank, they put us in this cool little position where we're giving it away willingly because we are the creator of this document. None of us knew that we were the creator of this document, first of all. I didn't know that I was giving the property away. I didn't know that the bank was going to take the note and deposit into their account. I didn't know that they were going to deposit 3 copies of that note into their account. I didn't know that their account was going to grow by 3 times the amount of the deposit. I didn't know that they were going to wire money to escrow. I didn't know that when they wired money to escrow, that their asset balance didn't decrease by the amount of that wire. I didn't know that all of this was going to take place before I got my keys. I just mentioned 8 elements of fraud. Now, once again, we talked about fraud, failure to disclose, and from that failure to disclose, there is a financial gain. Ask yourself the question, by their failure to disclose, was there a financial gain? I would say yes. I would say, once again, we're not even going to talk about the monetization of this note, but they received 4 times the amount of that loan before you even received your keys. Before you receive the keys, they receive 4 times the amount. My question to you, has that promise been fulfilled? Okay, ask yourself the question, has that promise been fulfilled? If that promise has been fulfilled, once again, and you're seeking remedy for the promise, this is definitely the process for you. But if you go through this process and you say, no, I still owe that promise. Well, guess what, folks? This isn't the process for you. You need to continue making that mortgage payment. You know, more power to you. I know that when I see an injustice, I'm one to step forward and step into that injustice and say, okay, I need to right the wrong that's been created. There's been a definite wrong that's been created on this document. I can go through and literally pick out in each paragraph where they're contradicting statements that, once again, the trustor created because I created the document. So I have to take responsibility for that because I didn't read the document and understand it correctly before I signed it. But at the same time, on the other side of the coin, it's their responsibility to explain to me the document. So they have a responsibility. Yes, they do. They have a responsibility to explain the note. They have a responsibility to explain the deed of trust and to give you all aspects of the note. So they were supposed to tell us that they were going to deposit 3 times the amount of that note into their bank. They were supposed to tell us that when they send that wire that their asset balance wasn't going to decrease. They should have told us that they weren't going to dump $200,850 on the table or give us a cashier's check or give us a money order, anything like that. They weren't going to give us physically a loan. They were just going to give us opportunity to have a home. If they would have told us that in the beginning, guess what? We probably would have been all in. I don't know. I may have signed on the dotted line, but at the same time, I probably would have done this process nonetheless and got my house free and cleared. But at the same time, your promise has been satisfied. It is a done deal. And based on the borrower's covenant, your property was free and clear. Now, what is the process for getting a free and clear house? I mean, everyone's saying, well, gosh, you know, is it hard? Yes, it's hard. Is it tough? Yes, it's tough. Does it require a whole lot on my part? Not necessarily. It just requires more mental toughness. Like I said, when I first started the process and I've completed the process, I went through a little depression because I realized that everything that had been set in front of me, that, you know, I work 40 years, I pay off my house, I put money in the bank, I retire, I go on vacation, I do all these different things. I had this process and I had this vision of how my life was supposed to be. Well, all of a sudden, paradigm shift, it blows it all up. Everything that I thought was true was no longer true. I don't know if that'll happen to you, but that's what happened to me, and this happened to many other people that we completed this process with. That is the toughness that has to take place on your part and the soul searching that has to take place on your part after you complete the process. So this process is just a start. I always recommend that you continue learning. Continue learning. You know, Winston's an awesome teacher, awesome person to step into as far as a mentoring through the CDs. Definitely step into those things. This is just the first phase. Our process consists of four levels. First of all, when we sign the deed of trust, we sign the note, giving the property away, we gave them all power. So we have to take that power back. Well, how we take that power back is through what's called a revocation of the power of attorney. We say, okay, you're no longer representing us, and we're taking our power back based on the elements of fraud. Now, like I said, we mentioned 8 elements of fraud. In our documents, we cite 28 elements of fraud. So the thing is, there is a lot of fraud that goes on in these documents. And they have to answer each element of fraud in order for them, once again, to step into it, back into the house after we've taken the possession of that house and taken full ownership of that home. Next thing that we do is we give them a notice. So we start off with a revocation of power of attorney, then we go into a notice. Now, what is a notice? I'm not sure if any of you have ever received this, but a 30-day notice of foreclosure. Let me give you that example. What happens if you don't answer that 30-day notice of foreclosure within 30 days? The bank takes your home. Yeah? Generally, that's what happens. So if you fail to answer that 30-day notice, the bank takes your home. What if you answer that notice? Could they still take your home? I had a circumstance with a loan modification company. Family was losing their home, and he called me and asked me if I could work the process with them. And he said they couldn't afford it, and I said yes, not a problem. He said they received a 30-day notice, and the time is almost up. I said, have them send the notice back, and have them say, I don't understand. Have them sign it, have them date it, do it in red ink, send it to the bank, send it to the trustee, just, I don't understand. He's as simple as that. He said, are you sure? I said, yeah, I think it'll work. I had never tried it, but I said, you know, basically they're sending you a notice, and I said, answer the notice. See, I don't understand. He sent the notice back to them, back to the trustee. It bought them 90 days. Literally 3 days from that, they were going into foreclosure because they answered that notice, bought themselves 90 days. Now they were able to complete the process in that time and they were able to keep their home. But the thing is, we have to answer notice. Okay, if we're the... Where I get that is from the deed of trust. On the deed of trust, it says, with a 30-day notice to the borrower, the trustee and the beneficiary can change this document with a 30-day written notice to the borrower. That's in the body of the trust, the body of your contract. Definitely read the contract. So with a 30-day written notice, the trustee and the borrower can change any part of this document. Now, me as a trustor shouldn't have the same power being the creator of this document, same power as the trustee and the beneficiary? Let's shelve that for 1 second. So, if I have the same power as a trustee and the beneficiary, and with a 30-day notice, the trustee and the beneficiary can put me on notice as the borrower, shouldn't I have the same right or greater rights to put them on notice with a 30-day written notice to the trustee and the beneficiary, me being the trustor? Okay, let's back up just a second. I'm the trustor, they're the trustee, they're the beneficiary. With a 30-day written notice to the borrower, they can change the trust. Okay. Shouldn't I have the same right as the creator of this document to give the trustee and the beneficiary a 30-day notice and change the document, i.e. take them off of the document? Once again, you got to think about that. I had an attorney stand up. I said, well, according to the Nevada revised statute, you can't do that. I said, probably not. But the Nevada revised statute has nothing to do with my contract. My contract reads that it's a uniform instrument and it operates under the UCC. So if it operates under the UCC, I can do that. But the Nevada revised statute, maybe not. The Nevada revised statute is not a part of this document. And this attorney literally was going to toss the table. He said, yes, it is. I said, you find in my document where the Nevada revised statute has any jurisdiction in my document, and guess what? I'll believe you. He read that document through and through. Matter of fact, he gave it to one of his partners, and they read it through and through. And he said, you're right. There is no mention of the Nevada revised statute. I said, no. But there is a mention of the Uniform Commercial Code. So guess what? That's what takes precedence on this document. Nevada revised statute is not a part of this document. Another individual said, well, isn't that fraud? I said, well, once again, what is fraud? And let's not throw around what we think fraud is, but let's talk about what it actually is. Remember, we said it's a failure to disclose. Okay. When I put them on notice, when I give them, revoke their power of attorney, and I send it to the bank, the servicing company, when I send it to the attorneys, when I send it to the trustee corp, when I send it to title companies, when I send it to everyone involved on this contract and on these two documents, is that a failure to disclose? When I said that to the attorneys, they almost fell over in their seat. And they said, well, the one thing you can't go to jail for is fraud. Because everyone has an equal opportunity to respond to whatever you're saying. So what we do on top of that is we throw one more curve. We put an affidavit in commerce. Now everyone, probably most people in here know, understand an affidavit. An affidavit is the truth. Is my kind of spoken word on a piece of paper, i.e., if I sign my, I'm going to use this term, and please don't throw me out of the room, 1040 form, and I sign under penalty of perjury, and I state that everything on this document is true, and I sign it, and they find something that's incorrect or that's not right or that was falsified, what do? And they come in, and they come in like a hurricane and just take everything that I have. Well, that affidavit has the same power when it's sent to one of us, an affidavit in commerce. When we send it to a bank or a banker, because now we're not sending it to a bank, we're sending it to an individual, and I'm going to put my banker hat on. I received that document as a vice president. And I'm asked by my bank to sign this document on the bank's behalf, I would say you're nuts. The bank, if I sign this document on the bank's behalf, it's not the bank that's in trouble if this document is not correct. It's me personally. Because when you sign an affidavit or you receive an affidavit, you have to give an affidavit. So we give them an affidavit, that banker receives the affidavit, and they have an opportunity to respond in the form of an affidavit. I think that's fair. If they really believe that everything that they've done on these documents were forthright, were integritous and truthful and honest, they wouldn't have a problem signing an affidavit stating that fact. So I give them my affidavit, they should be more than willing to say, no, this is incorrect, and send me back an affidavit. Wouldn't you think? We have yet to receive one affidavit from one bank, one attorney, one trustee company, one title company, you name the company, we have yet to receive. When we've done tons of these, and no one has ever formally given us a formal response in the form of an affidavit. Now, if they say that what we're doing is fraudulent and wrong, they should be willing to put their money where their mouth is. They should be willing to send us that affidavit. We have yet to receive one. We receive acknowledgement that they received the affidavit, but we never received a formal response to an affidavit. Now, what happens to an affidavit when it's not formally responded to properly. It becomes what's called a statement in fact. So it goes from a truth to a statement. And whatever is said on that affidavit is the truth. Okay, I want to back up and I want to discuss, I mean, we mentioned fraud, but according to UCC, fraud is the highest form of criminality. Sounds weird. I mean, when I did my studies and I checked out fraud and I checked out murder. I mean, and I never understood this, but I mean, an individual who murders someone and admits to it gets 5 to 10 years. Versus someone who takes $1 million, $2 million, $5 million from investors receives 30 years without a chance of parole. And I always said, well, why is that? I just don't get that. Well, according to UCC, Uniform Commercial Code, fraud is the highest form of criminality. Guess where murder falls? Number 5. Everything from 4 and above are white collar crimes. So the thing is, in court, you can lie. I mean, you can tell the, if you lie, you're maximizing your sentence. If you tell the truth, guess what? They'll have lenience on you. Now, once again, I know you guys are saying, court, judges, but I'm giving you the facts about the UCC. Why am I saying that? These documents, once again, we discovered 26 elements of fraud. And the 26 elements of fraud, only one is required to void out the entire contract. So that stack of paperwork that you signed at closing, if there's one element of fraud, literally everything, every document, every piece of paper that is touched is now voided. So we discovered 26 elements. All it requires is one under the UCC. So one element of fraud, everything is gone. So that's why we move towards sending an affidavit in commerce to the bank, to title, to attorneys, to trustee companies, to servicing companies, to MERS, everyone involved in that transaction, we send an affidavit to. Now they have to respond to the fraud. If they choose not to respond to the fraud, that's on them. Just like we choose not to respond to that 30-day notice. That's on us. If we don't respond to it, guess what? It's on. They're taking our home eventually. If we respond to it and continue to respond to their notices, we have a fighting chance. Thing is, it's all about contracts. It's all about agreement. It's all about implied agreements. When we don't respond to that 30-day notice, it's implied that whatever's on that 30-day notice is the truth. Once again, if we don't respond to that 30-day notice, whatever said on that 30-day notice, i.e., we're taking your home, is implied. There's an implication that it is the truth and we're accepting it. We, the borrower or the trustor, is accepting it as the truth. So when we send that affidavit to them, we're giving them our truth. Once again, if they fail to respond to it, it's implied that everything is said on that affidavit or that truth is now a statement in fact. So we're giving them the facts. In that fact, we state what we're going to do. We said, if you fail to respond to this formal affidavit with an affidavit, as you know, you're supposed to respond in an affidavit. We remind them. We say, you know, we're gentlemen. We say, please respond in the form of an affidavit. If you fail to respond in the form of an affidavit, we're going to take our house back. Now, why do I say back? Because we gave it away at the closing table. So we're taking our house back, and that's why they call it a reconveyance. Okay? We conveyed the property to the bank. Now we have to reconvey it back to us. I've talked to a few attorneys about this, and they say, you can't reconvey the property. You're the borrower. I said, no. Read my deed of trust. According to my deed of trust, I'm not the borrower. I'm the trustor. They said, well, only the trustee can do a full reconveyance. I fired the trustee. They're no longer a part of this contract. They're no longer part of my trust. I don't know about yours. They're no longer a part of my trust. So if they're not a part of my trust, How do they have the power to reconvey the property? I have the power now to reconvey the property. And that's what we do. Once again, we spell it out. We tell them we're going to reconvey the property if you don't do X. Just like they're going to take our property from us if we don't do X. So they don't do X, and we reconvey the property. So the full reconveyance is us receiving full title to that property. And yes, me, you, everyone, as the trustor of their deed of trust, has the power to fully reconvey the property because we created the document. We are the creator of this document. We're the ones who stand above the document. The document is not above us. The creator can never be below that which it created. So since we created this document, we are the ones that fully reconvey our property. I said, well, do they let you do that? I'm the boss of this document. What do you mean? Yes, I can do that. I can do whatever I want to this document. Matter of fact, I can give the property away once I do this process. I can give it to whomever I want. Well, I choose to give it to me versus you guys. No offense. But I take my property. I fully reconvey it. We go down, we record the full reconveyance. Once the full reconveyance is recorded, we have a second part of the process that moves the property into another trust. We figure if they put it in a, banks put it in a trust, there must be something about a trust that's pertinent. Notice they didn't put it in an LLC, a C Corp, S Corp, or limited partnership or any other entity. Obviously, there's something about a trust that's powerful, and there is. I mean, one is private. That's what I like about it. And that's something that Winston also loves. We move it into a trust. We move it into, if you're going to keep the property, is one strategy. If you're going to sell the property, there's another strategy. I don't want to get into all the different strategies right now because we'll step into that at a later date. But there are umpteen thousand different ways to maneuver once you have full control, once you have lawfully seized back your property. Are there any questions?